I knew that architecture was made possible by the confrontation of a precise form with time and the elements, a confrontation which lasted until the form was destroyed in the process of this combat. Architecture was one of the ways that humanity had sought to survive. It was a way of expressing the fundamental search for happiness.
Hi, the Aldo Rossi was way too long, so we chopped it up into two segments, and we're doing a little bit at the beginning to try and make it make more sense.
We've chopped it in half. Happy New Year, everybody.
Yeah, it's the last day of Hanukkah today.
Yeah, the Christmas trees are coming down.
It's the first year in 300-something years in which Hanukkah and Christmas have coincided exactly.
I think we're going to resume with the part where he's just about to become extremely famous.
The peak. We hadn't got on to the Venice Biennales yet.
We're about to resume with the Venice Biennale.
We're jumping into the salad days.
Yeah, Aldo the celebrity. Perhaps the most iconic single image of Aldo Rossi's work is his Teatro del Mondo, the Theatre of the World, a floating installation built for the 1980 Architecture Biennale in Venice. It's an image which is so recognisable, so reproduced, so pervasive on the internet that we were a little bit reticent to actually talk about it. It's like a wooden theatre on a barge. It moves through the city hosting performances and events. It looks like a child's toy. The scale is sort of more like a church spire. There's an octagonal tower with a pointed roof, painted blue. The whole thing is made of unfinished wooden boards. In common with the cemetery, there are these games of scale which are being played. The windows have become really tiny in comparison to the size of this sort of big boxy forms. But the real effects are created through this game of placing it next to recognisable buildings in the city.
People love this one. He loved it too.
Yeah.
It's like it's golden. It's the analogous city. I've got this building. I can move it around and put it in lots of different places in Venice. It's theatrical.
Yeah, it's a kind of like dramatization of the act of architecture. Sort of Rossi sees it. It's like a game.
Have you seen a single photograph of the inside?
No.
Of the theatre?
No. I'm not sure what it really looked like.
I had like a rounded theatre, thrust stage, standard. The theatre, in actuality, is Venice, which has always been a theatrical city. And the player is actually the barge.
Yeah.
And he'll get to move this castle round and try out all the different positions.
Yeah. And put it in front of the Doge's Palace.
Put it in front of the cathedral, put it in front of Palladio. Yeah. Like, and also, because it's something which has got no signifiers to its scale, you can make it as big or as small as you like, depending on like how telephoto you want to go.
And also, because it's so toy-like, it turns all the rest of the city into a game. That the confusion of scale becomes transferred onto its surroundings.
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking about all the ways in which it's theatrical. I have a criticism of his later work, which is that I think he makes everything into toys and the players become buildings. It's a stage set. It's a toy. It's a theatre.
The toyness of it is about this like very, very simplified, very boxy way in which its form is articulated, and it really looks like one of those little sort of wooden toy buildings.
It's like painted in, it's got a sort of Playmobil paint scheme, as in like, you know, half of it's like, it's got two colours. The windows look really suspiciously like they're like painted on. It made him really famous.
Around this time, Rossi was becoming extremely involved in the Biennale, and he had this long time ongoing collaboration with Paolo Portoghese, who was the director of the festival.
Who did great things. I mean, these are probably the most famous architecture biennales ever.
In particular, the one in which this one appeared, the 1980 show.
I swear the architecture are odd years.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, it's just what it says.
It says 79 in this book.
It says 79 there. Well, maybe it's 79. Yeah, I think they are meant to be odd years, but...
79.
So why does it keep going on about 1980? Anyway, around this time, it's the one in which there was created something called the Strada Novissima, the new street, which is this big showpiece, fake street in the Arsenale... which is filled with little, like, facades.
If you know the Arsenale, it's this old rope-making factory. There's, like, galleries, and it's this very, very, very long room.
It featured this whole series of showpiece facades and curiosities designed by, so here's a partial list, Hans Hollein, Michael Graves, Venturi Scott Brown, Robert Stern, Frank Gehry, Rem Koolhaas, Rob Krier. But they're basically all these like showpiece postmodern sculptures, aren't they?
They are, although the way in which they're postmodern is not necessarily the way postmodernism would evolve. They are more classical. Although they're jokey, they're still like the lurid, horrific colours and the like cheesy shapes hasn't happened.
Yeah, well, they're very mixed, and I'd say that there's like a lot more kind of conceptual. They're much more conceptually heterogeneous than postmodernism would really become. The Gehry one is this thing just made out of stud battens or something. It's this sort of completely
well, some
thing.
Of them are bent.
Yeah,
but yeah, it's like little bits of softwood timber.
Yeah, so it's this sort of the back of the facade is on the front.
It tells you which way the wind is blowing.
And I mean, one of the things which it tells you absolutely is that architecture is going to become about facades again. That the idea of designing facades and of the games which can be played formally with facade design and with the kind of juxtaposition of different little symbols and sort of typological features and all this kind of stuff is sort of legitimate again.
Also, history. This whole thing is framed as like the past strikes back, and every single one of them is historicist. These are all, every single one of them makes Beaux-Arts references. They subvert them. They're sort of like naughty schoolboys going, oh, I can put in a colonnade or something, but it's all neoclassical in a very literal way. And the descendants aren't just the postmodernists, they're also the gross neo-Palladians of our age.
Yes, this is at a moment when the proper crazies, the like bring back Albert Speer Brigade of like the Kriers and all that lot, were still more or less within the same like thought landscape as the like fun, frolicsome American Pomo guys who want to make shopping centres that appear to be falling down or whatever.
Yeah. And the Quinlan Terry Brigade.
Oh, yeah, they're like the completely light, thin and fatuous Pambury people. You know, it was obviously quite a fun show. So Hollein's one is this series of columns, some of which are like the bottom has fallen off, one of which is made of ivy.
One of their metaphors for like humanity, industry, modernism. And
yeah, one of them I think is a copy of Adolf Loos's proposal for the Chicago Tribune, which is like a building which turns into an enormous column the size of a
so
building.
So strong.
It's so crazy.
Which architect was it that we dealt with who said he was the only person to really understand that project? It might even have been...
It was Rossi.
It was Rossi, yeah. Rossi was the only person to understand that project.
I think the most photographed one is Hollein's. It's certainly the one which pops up in Google Images
Venturi's
the most.
Venturi's also is... Which is the, like, flat, three-column cardboard cutout temple with, like, suburbia behind it.
Oh, yes, at the bottom of which is, the modest man that he is, it's an image of one of his previous projects, his mother's house. It's a, like, flat-painted, temple.
Three
thing.
Doric columns in, as they would be designed. If you wanted, like, a Doric temple designed by clip art.
I think Hollein's is clearly the strongest one, these like, hanging columns. I suppose it's also because he had the opportunity to make it a route through, which I'm not sure everybody had.
They all are. So the way they work is that each person has a booth between two columns, and you go through every facade you go through into see their work behind. They're all exactly the same. They are the Arsenali piers. Yeah. The gallery of your work is behind the facade, and you go through the facade into it.
So at this point, what is Rossi at this point?
He's been famous in Italy for a while. He's beginning to be internationally famous. None of his books have come out in English.
They're certainly about to.
But people were hearing about him. But the interesting thing is that like both the New York Five and the Postmodernists are happy to rip him off. It's still like the architectural community hasn't kind of bifurcated. You know, we haven't got whites versus like both the whites and the greys.
Who are the greys?
They're the postmodernists.
Oh, right.
I don't know. Like why they're called the greys is, I think, very early on in the split.
So the show is interesting. It's kind of interesting for who's in it.
And the show did have the gatehouse. Rossi didn't do a facade, but he did the gateway in the court, which is like in the courtyard around the Arsenale, which is like kind of joke castle hoardings. Yeah. Bright pink.
Again, wood, isn't it?
Little, yeah, yeah. Very conspicuously, like, wooden timbers, like, between shuttering and Renaissance stage set. With little cute flags on the top of the pillars and things.
That's funny. Like, what's the name?
Like the triangle flags.
Yeah, Rossi is this sort of anticipation of the like, ubiquitous scaffolding board obsession, which is now the architecture of today.
It's even got your little crisscross Bartlett, like, scaffolding tops. Bright pink.
I don't know why they belong to me.
Because you went to the Bartlett. Didn't have any of that stuff at London Met.
I find it bizarre there are people still, like, bashing away at this kind of stuff. Naming no names.
No? Now's the time to name. No one's listening.
Yeah, no, actually, someone
on Google Plus, no one can hear you scream.
Everything is going to go wrong from here.
This is the inflection point where you no longer have to be serious. Like, in his in the architecture of the city, he has to pretend he's a scientist and make some serious endeavours to talk about geography, and his buildings have to have notions of functionalism. And after that, all the kids have taken over the school. And everyone is like, oh! And I can draw a moustache on it. Like, they start with jokes, and they are... And the mainstream of postmodernism happens.
After this show, the 80s are sort of the period of this, like, mainstream of postmodern architecture, in quotation marks, as language. So everyone is playing these games with elements which are meant to connote different things, and the building becomes this sort of symbolic message where you, like, stick some classical columns on it because you want the bank to look civic, or, you know, you like...
Yeah, but also the mainstream of postmodernism fuses together a lot of different things. It fuses together this stream of sort of historicism, but it also fuses together late American modernism of the sort of MetLife, like, air rights development, and, like, straightforward commercial junk, and things that are purely, like, design consumerism.
Oh, man, we're going to get onto the whole subject of, like, postmodernism. I've got a bit of a soft spot for some of the furniture, but the buildings mostly.
Oh, I actually like quite a lot of it. I think, like, we should do a whole big series on postmodernism, because then we can, like, be part of the defining of its historic legacy, which I think is going to go on in the next 15 years.
Yeah.
What's he called, the painter? The one who, like, the painter with reference to Rossi.
Oh,
De Chirico. There's a reference between De Chirico and Rossi, which is that they both come, like, at the beginning of their movements. They're not quite... They've got one foot in both camps, and they're both the best person in them.
Yeah, everyone's doing facades, and postmodernism is going to become this game of facades, this, like, slightly facile game of, like, playing around with different elements and... Everyone having a grand old time with larks, and, you know, your opinion on that is, like... Anyway, so Rossi at this point is... He's now a superstar architect on the world stage. And during the 80s, he amasses a global portfolio of luxury and prestige projects. He also becomes a designer of objects and tableware, an artist of expensive and highly collectible drawings and collages. There's scores of buildings from this period, and we're only going to focus on a couple because, quite frankly, a lot of them are not very good.
We should mention a couple of the stinkers, because not at the beginning, but at the end, some of them are so bad.
Let's talk about some bad ones then. So,
yeah.
So he's kind of building them all over, and one of the things about his early career is that despite all his rhetoric being about the architecture of the city... He hasn't really had a chance to do anything of substance in a real urban space until now.
I think some of the urban, like the urban ones, always have intention that the space outside the buildings is the most important place, I think.
Do you think
the space in the cemetery outside the buildings is the most important space in terms of representation. I think the space outside the apartment buildings is very important.
Yeah.
The most important and most represented space in the schools is the courtyards. And it's where the assemblage of elements which relate to each other and build up an urban setting, or an urban setting if you define, like, a building as a city, sort of declines.
That falls away completely. Actually, as soon as he gets a chance to actually build in a real city, he loses interest in this. He's much more.
He doesn't lose interest in it completely. It's just that
it becomes completely unconvincing.
Becomes obsessed with baubles as well.
There's suddenly all these Aldo Rossi buildings all over the world. One of them is in Japan. He built
several are in Japan. Actually, he had an office in Japan.
He built the most sort of striking of which is a big hotel he built in Fukuoka, which is a southern city in Kyushu, which is a big luxury hotel, and it's a whole block more or less, or it's certainly the end of a sort of city block.
Yeah, it's very big. It takes a lot of space.
It's massive, sort of pink. It's like a raised plinth with stairs going up to it, on top of which is sitting a sort of big cuboidal building with a colonnaded front.
The front is the over, like the thing. All of his projects have something that's just photographed above everything else, yeah. One or two things. And the thing that's photographed here is it's near a river with like one row of scenic sort of fishermen's huts in between it and the river. And it's a picture over the river of this facade, which is completely blank, no windows or doors, and that are visible. I mean, there's a door at the bottom. And it's made of massive, monolithic, not terrazzo, like, what's it called? Like marble, but not marble. Anyway, like solid pieces of like this Iranian incredible...
Travertine,
like solid pieces, solid travertine columns.
Yeah,
in a square.
And when we striking. Say when we say solid, they're like what, like 800 mil diameter, a meter diameter. They're
yeah,
so
more
big.
Like the meter. Yeah. Yeah,
like imagine a meter diameter column, and it's on every story for 10 stories.
This was proper late 80s money no object Japan.
This is yeah, like, this is the bubble.
This is like
it's hard
like
to imagine this without
spend any amount of money. Like, oh, money, oh, should we make it out of gold?
What's more expensive than gold?
It's 8x8, 64.
Yeah.
The whole facade is travertine as well, on that front. And then it's travertine, except for the bits that are, like...
Solid copper.
Solid cast copper. It's not quite, I mean, like, other people have done more, like, Mies van der Rohe had a onyx, in the Noyes Museum, it's a polished onyx service core.
Strong move.
Alto had cast glass walls.
Onyx is one of those great materials. They were going to specify it for one of the libraries in Yale, and they realised that...
there wasn't enough in the world?
It was affordable, but there wasn't enough in the world. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a semi-precious stone.
Yeah.
It's like saying, I want it in emerald.
Yeah.
It looks striking from that facade. I've never been there.
It looks quite amazing. We've been on Street View, which I would...
On Street View, it's a dog.
I would recommend
like,
going
sides,
on
the sides of it look like...
It turns into these one of those like weird sort of semi-automated... like in inner city car park things that are all over Japan.
Yeah, it's got a distinctly premier class feel.
Yeah, which is okay. I mean, these things have their own charm. What is unconvincing about it is that it makes a certain kind of urban promise with this like piazza which it creates on top of the plinth around the thing, but which is actually like totally counterfeit. And
yeah, I mean, the counterfeit thing has been there from the beginning, right? In the housing estate. It's got this amazing public space, this loggia, which goes nowhere, from nowhere, and is about nothing. I think it becomes worse as time goes on.
I think so. I think that there is an issue in that it's sort of a quirk of the work that he got, but that his early projects are all in suburban, ex-urban contexts. And what he does with them is to create, like, simulacra or... not simulacra, like models or... like microcosms or like fragments of something which is meant to be just distinctively urban and which to a greater or lesser extent is able to have like a little pocket of sort of urban condition on its own in this otherwise like suburban context.
I mean, the thing is, he thinks that buildings are more important than people, and in cities that just ain't so. Like, the Monument to the Partisans kind of works because there's a density of people there. I think probably, actually, the housing block, actually, as an urban thing, doesn't work at all.
No.
Because it's in the middle, it's in this absolutely crap place. I'm sorry, but, like housing...
Suburban Milan
suburban
listeners,
housing
writing.
Blocks, like, between two, like, motorways, consisting entirely of tower blocks with like gravel around them.
I think whatever they are, they can't really aspire to the condition of like an urban piazza. So then when he gets successful, he gets the opportunity to work in like dense and historic urban contexts. But in this rather bizarre way, his projects start to turn their back on their city and to actually maintain this thing of being little isolates, little kind of turned in blank.
That's the problem with the Japanese stuff, right?
Yeah.
He gets really Japanese-y, as in he starts like writing in COD Japanese on his documents, and he starts like getting very excited about little red stamps, but he puts like Italian buildings.
And it's not just the Japanese buildings, actually all of them become... That even the ones which are inside the city turn their faces sort of inward.
And he's become an architect, like, honking the same buildings around. All the same sort of... Like, he's known for this brand. And actually, even the customers want it.
Yeah.
Like, when you become a brand architect, you're selling a product. And he sort of made the product. Yeah. He sort of did it. And he committed a myriad of sins.
Pick out some bad ones and let's talk about them.
Oh, the Disney headquarters is interesting. The Disney headquarters is, I think you should look that up, because that's a major building of his. He's famous for this. This is one of his most famous, one of two or three famous buildings in America, which is in Orlando, as you'd expect from Disney. And it is his shapes. It's got the octagonal building with the peaked roof, and it's got the little square windows, and it is built in a style which is... very much like buildings in Orlando, with mirror glass and sort of beige facade. Did they actually build the, like... I don't think they built the really crazy bit. It was going to have a cone with, like, eight weird glass wings with giant columns at the end of them.
Because they also have one by Michael Graves, which has, like, a sort of classical... It has a kind of classical order with Mickey Mouse's at the top. They're just these sort of big forms, big, like, rectangular forms. There's a sort of a pavilion thing outside the front of it with a pointy roof. But as you say, the windows are all filled with, like, classic Orlando mirror glass. This sort of, the, like, greenish tint.
It's a mistake. It's not good. Do you think it is in any way good? The supermarket projects are in the middle. They're quite fun.
Yeah.
The, like, one with all the lettering around the tops. I don't have a picture of it. It's not in this book, but it's quite good fun.
God, it's a hell of a big thing, isn't it?
The Orlando one is massive. A lot of his later projects are, like, standard. Whatever was the city's style. So there's, like, designs for Canary Wharf or Edinburgh or Bari or Milan or Tokyo or Kuala Lumpur. It, like, takes their standard office block and... does some slightly Rossi shapes with it.
I think that it creates... There's, like, a real sense of pathos. You know, he puts these, like, little pyramid, like a Roman... displaced Roman tomb in the middle of the roundabout in the car park.
Yeah, just like they are in Rome. You know, they are in car parks and things. But, like, we should talk about some of the slightly more fun, fruity ones as well. Yeah. I quite like the... a Japanese showroom.
We alluded at the start to the fact that a lot of these forms reoccur, and one of the ones which is very obvious because no one else is using it in the same way as him is the equilateral triangle as a kind of form, a sort of extruded cookie-cutter form stuck on everything. I mean, Louis Kahn did use triangles a lot, and some of them were equilateral, but he never used them as this sort of thing stuck on the outside.
There's a couple in... Scarpa's got a couple.
Okay, yeah, he has this quote where he says, I've always had a strong interest in objects, instruments, apparatus, tools. Without intending to, I used to linger for hours in the large kitchen on Lake Como, drawing the coffee pots, the pans, the bottles. I particularly loved the strange shapes of the coffee pots, enamelled blue, green, red. They were miniatures of the fantastic architectures I would encounter later. Today I still love to draw these large coffee pots, which I liken to brick walls, and which I think of as structures that can be entered.
Which, yes, I mean, they probably can. So he has a pretty awful habit. It's fine, and in fact, it's no bad thing to make table ornaments in the shape of buildings. That's not a bad thing. It's a nice joke. And he made lots of, like, one of his famous, along with the famous coffee pot, one of his famous, like, objet d'art is a thing that he called the scientific theatre, which is a theatre set with buildings as actors at the sort of puppet theatre scale, which was his scientific inquiry into the nature of the city by, like, hello, I'm the Chrysler building. Hello, I'm another building. like that.
We should talk about this theatricality, because one of the criticisms I think you can have of the later buildings is that they become these sort of theatrical elements, and that they become entirely like inward. They become about this sort of inward play of these elements whose justification is largely some sort of internal symbolic kind of narrative, like a attachment that Rossi himself has to them, and which in many cases he isn't really capable of even of articulating. It's like, I feel nostalgic about this, I'm going to kind of put these things
which
in
is often
there.
Because it's blank. It's a blank thing that he remembers. There are a number of problems going on. I mean, there's the failure of theatricality, which is where it has become literal. There's another failure, which is that he just, like, assembles a load of his tropes, the inverted cone, the triangle, rich things, and plonks it wherever without thinking about it much. There's a strange failure, which is a contextualization, which is cities are important, I must build something which is like almost the same as what's next to it. So he builds a number of what are, but if it's in like Canary Wharf or suburbia or Orlando, you end up getting building that's sort of like those buildings but more expensive, with strange like monumental shapes. That's a sort of a failure, really. I mean, occasionally it works. Like, there's some, the Scholastic, if it's in a nice area, which is in the cast iron bit of New York, which has got a cast iron front, well, cast iron back, and a sort of, you know, and they sort of make nice, like, infill expensive buildings. But he never, because his idea is nostalgic, and the nature of nostalgia is that the longing for something doesn't really exist. It's the longing for an idea. It's the longing for a memory, and memory is false and fleeting and has gone through, you know, the weird smoke and mirrors of desire.
And yeah, and kind of flattening as well. In the architecture of the city, the whole rhetoric is about observation, really a kind of empiricism.
But not only observation, although he never quite says it, he alludes a great deal to building around people's notion of memory and experience and allowing the person to drive and the collective. And in fact, he never really succeeds. His architecture always dominates.
It becomes a kind of a narcissism. It becomes a like obsession with the... I think that it's certainly in the rhetoric of the architecture of the city that there are lessons which emerge out of observation of the city. He has this nice formulation where he talks about, for the architect, observations are like instruments, that they're sort of the same thing, that you collect all of these observations and they become the sort of tools with which you just construct the building. But at a certain point, he stops collecting the observations, and he's just really kind of rolling out stuff that he has already in his head somewhere.
He just collects memories and then produces reinterpretations of them. I don't know where to go. I mean, there's a couple more buildings we should talk
about.
Well,
we could mention, so there's the Berlin. I mean, the Bonn and Fanton Museum in Maastricht is like a good example of this kind of thing. The like, we've got all of these, we've got the sort of tower that looks like an artillery shell. We've got all these, this kind of collage
of
different
strange elements.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't
think
that one is a particular, it's not one of the best ones.
I don't think it's bad.
But I don't think it's bad. I think it's actually got some things that are quite strong architecturally in it.
Yeah, sort of shell, lighthouse, grain silo, sort of illusions in it.
Yeah, I quite like that thing because it's so strange.
No, it's actually become a kind of a grotesque, it's become a like an eccentricity. I did want to talk briefly about his importance, and I think his drawings are a big part of that.
You should talk about the importance, but I think for him, they are the primary output. It is true that the main thing that an architect produces often is a drawing. They are the main tool of both experimentation and command.
And so many of the buildings never go beyond that stage that it becomes the main thing that you kind of reflect on.
But the problem with his buildings is that, his drawings, is that when he's talking about drawings, they're not drawings which are intended to analyze a building or instruct. They are beautiful pieces of graphics in which design is subservient to the needs of collage. He doesn't take on challenges.
So many of them are collages, and they're collages which take in historical plans, which he's sort of copied and cut up. Historical like etchings and images and plans of his own buildings, the sort of drawing which he's done on top of them, a lot of them have titles that, you know, think they're called things like The Analogous City. They're meant to speak to this sort of slightly hazy ideas, which are also appearing in his writing about parts of the city representing the city, or the building having this sort of like metaphorical relationship to the city.
And more and more they become drawings of his own drawings cut up and stuck together.
Yeah, well, you were saying that he literally used to, like, if he didn't have enough to sell, he'd cut them in half and draw another.
Yeah, there's a famous anecdote of him like tearing one in half and just drawing the halves of two other drawings onto it. And the other thing would be to stick a load of them together and then fax them to himself and then draw over the fax. Or chop up faxes and then, like, get people to paint them.
The margin on the drawings is a lot better than the margin on building the buildings.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I think the drawings always produce plenty of free cash flow. And I would love to have some.
Because of his drawings, he still casts a very long shadow in the output of architectural schools.
He wasn't present in my education, although people who were more clued in knew about him.
I don't think people really know about him, but I think that his graphics are very present in the output of architectural schools. And in various ways, his famous drawings of the cemetery, these like dark and moody sections which draw on kind of early, you know, like neoclassical drawings by people like Boulez and Ledoux.
He makes a lot of explicit references. Like, he copies Boulez drawings, he copies de Chirico.
And that stuff is still knocking around in a big way. Like, I see it every day.
I mean, Boulez is massive, right?
Yes, but I think that he is sort of responsible for taking that particular graphic into, like, bringing that.
That he made it simpler. The Boulez are kind of classical, fussy classical etchings, and he does them as instant things. Him and Kuhlhaus, obviously, who also,
you know, within architectural academia, I was reading. I've read a few books recently where he pops up as this sort of cult.
Tell me about them.
So one was I was reading a bit of Jeremy Till's book, Architecture Depends, which is this sort of cri de coeur by the, like, misfit architecture professor. He's the husband of Sarah Wigglesworth and a sort of, well, I think he now runs Central
St. Martin's. He's probably as famous as Sarah Wigglesworth. He's pretty famous.
He's like at odds with everything around him, and like, certainly that's his like presentation in the book. And so for him, like, the rhetoric of Rossi in the city seems to have been incredibly attractive. But he describes in his book as this kind of like moment of this like epiphany about the failure of architecture is going to actually see what Rossi buildings are really like and how the built reality fails to articulate the like promise of the text.
I want to completely disagree with that. I think the text of The Architecture and City is an abject failure. What people are attracted to is this underwelling of emotion and sense of a city. I mean, there are some intelligent things in it, but
great ideas in there.
Well, the reason why I'm saying that is because people react to it as if it's some sort of messianic and cabalistic text, and it's neither of those. It's got a few good ideas, most of which have serious elements of wrongness, which he never confronts. I think things like the cemetery, though, are amazing buildings.
Rossi is like the sort of cool guy who sold out or whatever for these people, I think. Rossi is like this person who, in a rather transitory way, represented this sort of cool rebellion.
But I think it's because they never really went into it. I think if they'd really read it, they would have seen the problem.
Well, it's not that there aren't problems, but I don't think that all the later architecture is latent in the book, actually. I don't think that that's the case. No, I think the things which are wrong with the later architecture are different things.
They're different things, yeah. Like, it becomes more trivial. There's less of an attempt. Like, what he's attempting is lesser later on, often. Although some of the buildings are good, actually. Some of the later buildings even are good. But the problem, which is like trying to sell people snake oil, is there from the beginning. I mean, trying to say this discussion I'm having, this argument, actually communicates to the truth of this oceanic feeling. The feeling is just an emotion. It's an emotion about nostalgia, the city, the archetype, which is magnetic. That's magnetically attractive. We will analyze buildings in an archetypical, psychological, way. Also, we will analyze built cities as the sum of everything they are, both their phenomenal and psychological reality in a sort of subconscious level, and their noumenal totality, every bit of the building in them. That is impossible.
It's interesting to read the autobiography. The moments which he comes back to again and again, the key observations, are moments of what you might describe as like near, pretty close to the ineffable. It's that he's in a church and in Milan, and the door opens and the fog which is outside comes in and invades the inside of the church.
Aren't those the moments you remember most?
Of course they are, but they could. But those can't be your observational
That's
instruments
it.
For architecture,
They're not observational instruments.
They're so precious.
That's those are your observational
but they can't,
instruments
you can't do anything
for religion.
With them. Poetry.
For coming to terms with, like, death.
But it's this, yeah, it's this thing of, like, something amazingly beautiful has happened, and then you think about time. Oh, well, I mean, we've given him a bit of a kicking, but, like...
No, he's one of my absolute favourite architects of all time. There are very, like, there's a few, there's not very many people I like as much as his. He might not be, as an architect, he's not someone who's able to do everything at all. He's able to do a few things.
But I think he's a good person to be critically interested in. And I think, like, the metaphor of the toilet book is, I think, a good one. You can always dip into Rossi, I find now, and find, like, some delightful little aphorism, normally buried in a paragraph that doesn't make any sense and doesn't really connect to it. Right, well, thanks for listening. We've become aware of the fact that some of our listeners exist and they can't possibly all be our friends. I think we've probably already said this already.
Yeah, some of them can't be our friends. Yeah. Please contact. We need attention.
Yeah, tell us what you think of the programme. We are aboutbuildingsandcities@gmail.com. We're about_buildings on Twitter, about_buildings on Instagram, although a lot of that is just me taking photos of nonsense. It's not necessarily very well. Yeah, do rate and review us on iTunes and all that kind of thing if it floats your boat. But we'd love to know what you think of the programme. It's very much intended to be one side of a conversation, and at the moment we are in the kind of end of radio situation, shouting into the dark. Yeah, do tell us if you'd be interested to hear about anything in particular, and we might not do it, but...
We might do it eventually.
Yeah.
We're not going away.
No.
I know we have long pauses, it's just it takes so blooming long to do an episode.
It's very hard, and also life has got a bit complicated recently, but it's...
Yeah, yeah, we do.
You know,
we
destiny, are both... destiny has been interrupted in various ways.
But... I think we're both fully employed.
Yeah,
I think at the moment. That's a fair description.
So we had an email from our correspondent Daniel Lauand, essentially, I'm not going to read the whole thing out, but essentially kind of affirming a thing which I think we've both observed as well, which is that Rossi and his the sort of disappearance of Rossi and his kind of ideas from architectural discourse.
I mean, actually, I think stylistically what happened was at places like London Met, he became such a cliche copying him that it was just absorbed into the conscience, and then the name slowly disappeared. But maybe even the style is going a bit now.
Yeah, I was having a conversation with someone who was reminiscing about being a student during the kind of high times of Rossi, Rossi love among the student body, and saying, yes, we all did that. The main thing was that we all did those windows without any frames. That was like...
Yeah. That feels... I mean, to be fair, he's not the only person who's done windows without a frame.
No, that's what she remembered about it. And I still, actually, to be honest, I think the part of his influence which is still very present is the graphics, the kind of the moody section, which I think is a thing which kind of comes into vogue again in the early 70s around the time of those cemetery drawings.
He's actually contributed several graphical forms, because there's the, like, really detailed flat black and white collage, which he kind of moves away from, but you still see them knocking about at places that, like, the huge graphical presentation. The, like, flat painted sort of oil paint semi-perspective, and then his, like, scratchy drawings, which is a style that other people had used and actually has got a lot of classical influence, but he definitely was a master of them, slightly to the detriment of his buildings often.
For me, I think that it's a bit of a shame that Rossi has disappeared, because I think that there is a kind of a contemporary Rossi. You know, I think that there's a potentially a kind of parametric Rossi. I think that there's a kind of like computer age Rossi who I think it would be really interesting for people to rediscover. I think that sort of...
Can you unpack that a bit?
Yeah, so what I think it would be, if you think about like the way in which he sort of proposes and understands the city, you know, it's understood as type. It's understood as things which are kind of recognized for their similarities, but without necessarily... rather than for some kind of underlying, like, purpose or, like, essential sort of abstract justification. You know, these are things which are, and you can kind of tie them together. And I was thinking that there's this kind of weird sort of symmetry between that and like, the sort of image recognition of like, neural networks. That you know, you have the kind of the dominant paradigm in computer architecture at the moment is that you put in loads of parameters and you define lots of kind of formulas and everything is like typed and explicit and then something comes out at the end. But there is actually this other thing which at the moment has no purchase in architecture really, which are sort of computers which look at a million things and then decide what things are. And in a way, this is like, you know, I think sort of Deep Dream is a kind of a sort of a Rossian computer more than
well, the point where I might diverge from that slightly,
yeah,
is that I think all of his sort of tables and things are really all just justifications for his subconscious and what he thinks is sort of religiously important or like spiritually important, and his like increasing detritus of like weird, you know, the massive fat column, whatever.
I think that maybe the other thing I would say in Rossi, which is that there are lots of things, I think that maybe like a more partial reading of Rossi, a lot of people, what they've taken...
All readings of Rossi are partial.
Necessarily, yeah, no, I agree. Like they all have to be, because it's contradictory and so kind of rich. But I think that there are a whole series of really productive, like very partial readings of the architecture of the city, which could turn into something really interesting on their own. And I think of the discussion of residential districts, which in a way is also a sort of understanding of emergent architecture under certain parameters. Yeah, I think what people have tended to take from him is the sort of presiding mood of kind of the buildings and the kind of the figure and all this sort of thing. And I think it would be good for people to actually read the book and make something different of it from the sort of received view of it.
Yeah, I mean, you could definitely call it a call for stripping functionalism out of parametricism and replacing it with archetypical subconscious.
Yeah.
Hard to do, though, right? Because, anyway, I think this is going on.
Yeah, I mean, it's all gone a bit mad. Yeah, okay. Well, that's the end of that. Please keep writing in. And, yeah.
Hope you have a great new year.
Yeah, have a great new year. Let's try not to destroy the world.
For anyone living in the path of a plume.
Yeah. Yeah, duck and cover.
Yeah. Yeah, remember, beware of radioactive water.